Indie Nation. All indie, all the time.
And what would you say the style is?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's in the jazz category because it's music that has an acoustic piano, an upright bass, and a drum kit, and it's not using like heavy rock beats, at least for most of it. There are some parts where we get pretty, where we can resemble rock a little bit, and some parts where we resemble hip hop, but it's all just instrumental as a piano trio, and it's largely improvisatory. There are compositions, but within the compositions, there's a lot of improvisation. So that coupled with the jazz harmonies and jazz mentality that I'm using in the compositions, I mean, it generally falls into the jazz category, but it draws influence from all these different styles. Like, I can't really write anything that doesn't incorporate everything that I've listened to in the past. And I love hip hop music. I love rock. I love dance music. I was in an electronica band for a while that would just play packed clubs that had people dancing with glow sticks and, you know, crazy light shows and stuff. So all these influences that I've had have basically filtered into my compositions and into my playing. So, you know, I'd call it jazz, but that's just for marketing. Like, a genre is really just a marketing tool. It's all just music. You know, when Charlie Parker was starting out, he didn't want to call this stuff jazz. Eventually he did, you know, but it was for marketing reasons. You know, all the best musicians in most genres, the really innovative ones, when they were starting out, they were just doing music, and then it got titled later.
We'll be right back. station, listeners. As you probably figured out, you're listening to an interview with Greg Sparrow. You can find out more about this talented young jazz musician at gregsparrow.com and Mivio's Music Alley. That track you just heard was Ba Ba Do Dat. And, well, let's let him explain some more about himself, music, and all, and Lumpy's going to shut up.
0 grams trans fat, 0 calories, all good, all of the time. Indie Nation.
How about some bio information on you for our listeners?
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, you're Greg Sparrow, but...
No, definitely. All right, basically where I come from. The first thing that I should say is both my parents are pianists. So when I grew up, my dad's a professional rock and country producer and songwriter, and my mom's a classical pianist. So as I was growing up, there was always music in the house, and I was always jamming on the piano. I've got a photo of when I was like, I must have been like one year old or something, and I could probably barely walk. I don't know. I was sitting on my grandma's lap, banging on the keys of the piano. Yeah, I probably wasn't making any music at that time, but at some point in my early childhood, it turned into music. I don't remember when, but I remember my mom has stories of when I was like 3, I was writing some little tunes on the piano and sounding things out. And my mom would teach piano lessons at home all day, and so I would always hear the piano lessons going on. And then, so as I grew up, I just, the piano was just part of me. I joined my first professional band when I was 14 years old. It was called the Slack Daddies. It was a blues band based in Highland Park. I was 14 and all the other guys were in their 30s and 40s. We played around Chicago and around Highland Park at smoky bars because smoking was legal back then. And then after that, I joined a band called Bucket Shop, which was a jazz fusion band, which that's where I draw a huge part of my influence from. We played some pretty difficult material, like different Weather Report songs and Jean-Luc Pani songs and Jaco Pastorius. And that was my first professional album. It's called Bucket Shop, Fossil Fuels in the House That Mouse Built, that we recorded in Real Sound Studios here in, I believe it's located in Evanston, just north of Chicago. So after that, I went to college for music. Meanwhile, all this time, I'm in a few different bands, and at some various points, I was writing music for some local plays. I did the music to some Ionesco plays that were performed in Chicago at one of the theaters here. Then, so I went to University of Illinois for piano, to study jazz piano there. It was a pretty crazy, it was a great experience, but also a pretty crazy experience. I got my ass kicked pretty badly. The music director there, the piano teacher, was Chip Stevens, who is like has ridiculous chops. I mean, he can play faster than anyone that I've ever heard. I mean, he's up there with like what Oscar Peterson was able to do when he was alive. So I studied under him for 4 years. That's where I got a lot of my jazz vocabulary. In the meantime, I was playing in bands still in Chicago. I would drive back and forth. It's a 3-hour drive from Champaign to Chicago. And I would drive pretty much every weekend for at least my junior and senior year. And then I also had a regular gig on Tuesdays, so I would make the 3-hour drive to Chicago and then back after the gig. Pretty crazy. I had some pretty near-death experiences on the road, driving back at like 5 in the morning.
It's pretty amazing what musicians will do for a gig, isn't it?
I know, man. Looking back, it's kind of like, I'm like, wow, that was pretty intense. I mean, I was pretty motivated, but also because of that, I got some really great opportunities. Like I was on one of the bands that I was in Chicago while I was studying in Champaign was with this guy, Frank Catalano, who I played on his album, The Mighty Burner, which ended up becoming a worldwide bestseller in jazz. It debuted at number 11 on the worldwide jazz billboards and stayed on there for like 22 weeks, I think, sold hundreds of thousands of copies, which is pretty good for a jazz record.
Yes, it is, because that's not the mainstream market focus. It hasn't been for a lot of years. I'm pretty familiar with jazz and blues because of my instructors when I studied guitar. Ever hear of John Stiebel Jr.?
John Stiebel. The name's really familiar, but I can't place my finger on it.
He wrote a book that Mel Bay was trying to buy for years, called John Stiebel's Pro and Jazz Chords for Stage Musicians.
Oh, okay.
Knuckle Busters.
Yeah.
I was actually, in bands fairly early. I was in three bands before I was 16 years old as a guitarist. Oh, yeah? Because one of my idols is John Lennon. And, you know, I knew the Who chords and I knew the Lennon chords.
Nice.
But I was, it was ironic because I was actually in a country band, a polka band, and a metal band at the same time.
Wow.
And I'll tell you what, people always ask me, like, polka? And I'm like, you know, go join a polka band. That's some tough stuff to play because they play fast.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some tough stuff. I don't think I could do polka anymore. Yeah. I mean, I'm too unpracticed. I couldn't do much anymore, but I definitely couldn't do polka.
Saying that, I have a lot of respect for polka bands. I remember there's a band called the Polkaholics that I became friends with at the Chicago Music Awards last year. One of my albums was nominated for a Chicago Music Award as Best Jazz Album in Chicago, and one of the groups that was nominated for a different genre was the Polkaholics, and I remember listening to their music, and I was just like, wow, that's really difficult stuff to play.
Yeah. Another one I have a lot of respect for because he does so much stuff in polka style and he's so creative is Weird Al.
I love Weird Al,
I can't,
man.
You know, I mean, I love Dr. Demento music. I love that type. I mean, you know, we're very eclectic here at Indie Nation, and Lumpy's so eclectic, he borders on schizophrenia. All my friends say, you know, you play music that nobody's ever heard, and it's all different, and it's all good. And I'm like, you know, that's a pretty good compliment. Now we were talking about Green Day earlier. Now, have you ever seen Weird Al live?
I've never seen Weird Al live, no.
He does the coolest thing. You know how he does all the video parodies and he does that Polkas on 45 thing almost every... Okay, he will drop a projection screen and he will play the original videos and sync them to his tempo. So you see Alanis Morissette moving like, you know, double speed. But the funny, riotous thing is he almost always does a Green Day thing.
Okay.
When the Green Day video pops up, it's going normal speed.
Interesting.
The one guitarist from Green Day says, you know, I listen to Hendrix, I listen to Jimmy Page. And he goes, I'm not going to play like that. He goes, I just learned to play really fast. Well, I've given the acoustic several listens. Who would you say your influences were with that? Because, for example, I believe it's track 4, Flow.
Yes.
I think I hear some Philip Glass in there.
Yes. It's funny. Yeah, people don't normally catch the Philip Glass influence, but I'm a big fan of minimalist music. Minimalist art in general also, actually. I've created some art pieces and they're all very sparse and minimal. But in my music, I mean, oftentimes people wouldn't be able to hear that because I use a lot of notes. Like in Flow, I don't really, you know, hold anything back in the solo of that one. Like, it's pretty fast and pretty crazy, but the idea of it, the like foundation of the tune is definitely influenced by minimalist music. That's something that I got into a lot when I was in college. I actually have a recording of my best friend in college, Sam Schmetterer, and we I believe it was 12 hours, we rented out the one of the concert halls there and did a recording, a 12-hour minimalist recording. Just using all the different instruments, the different pianos and different marimbas and vibraphones, and mostly like percussion and keyboard instruments, and did an actual 12-hour minimalist piece, like improvised, that we recorded overnight. It was from like 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. But yeah, that was one of my passions in college. I haven't explored it too much recently, but I feel like it still comes out in my music.
And how do you feel about touring? I mean, obviously, every musician likes to play in front of a crowd. But, I mean, like, I know just from, like, you know, I had a day job, and we'd be in a band, mm-hmm. and we'd go set up at this club. And the mm-hmm. next day, you're in just the next city over after mm-hmm. work. And the day after that, you're maybe back in the city you were before, but the bar next door.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 days of that, it feels like a month.
I know what you mean. Well, I actually love touring. A lot of artists get burnt out on touring because it's so challenging on the body, because you're in a car or a plane or whatever all the time. And I'm involved for an extended period of time, say it's a month. You know, it's difficult to not be at home in your bed with all of your normal comforts, but I love it. I mean, I want to do more of it. I don't feel like I do enough touring to satisfy my touring craving at the moment. I'm hoping to do more in the near future, especially to support this album that I'm releasing. It's something that I just love. I feel like it gets so, the music that you play gets so passionate because you're basically living with the people that you're playing it with nonstop, and you form this connection with them that, I mean, for jazz music especially, when you have that, when you form a deeper connection with someone by being around them all the time, even if you guys are annoying the hell out of each other, the music becomes something that's like, it's indescribable, the how it goes to another level, and the connection that you're able to form with each other and then with the audience. Because I feel like music is all about connection, you know, when, at least the music that I play, it's all about the communication that you have between the different people that are playing and between the different people in the room, the energy of the different people who are listening. And when that connection gets augmented by a really intense experience like touring, you can get to some really amazing heights. Insomniac was one of my first records, actually, that I bought. When I was, I believe I was in fifth grade, and I remember buying the CD, and I had to transfer it to tape because I only had a little Walkman tape player. And then I remember walking to school, bobbing my head to that, walking over to the bus, listening to Insomniac. I love that. I grew up on Green Day and Weird Al, actually.
Did Insomniac have any influence for Insomnia?
You know, that's funny. I didn't even think about that. I don't think so. I mean, it's very possible, I suppose.
I got to tell you, that was a tune that I really thought captured and presented Insomnia well.
Thank you.
You can hear like the nighttime, and mm-hmm. you can hear like the conflict in it really well. Very, 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 very well done piece.
Thanks. Yeah, I think I wrote that at like 4 a.m. when I was in a practice room at U of I, just like in the middle of the night.
fusion blues. Where'd that come from?
That's a good question, actually. I don't even really know. The song itself came to me in a dream, oddly enough. It actually, like, one night while I was asleep, I woke up at 2 a.m., and this song, I woke up, like, just as I had finished playing this song. I played it in my dream, and, like just like I knew it, you know? And I woke up, and I was like, I have to write this down right now. So I got up and went over to my computer and just punched it into Sibelius, how I had heard it in my dream, and then it was there, you know? And I thought it kind of sounded, like, the one I originally wrote it, it sounded kind of Latin-y and kind of fusion-y, but it's actually a blues form, just very, very reharmonized. And so I just called it Latin Fusion Blues. Yeah. it took us a really long time to learn to play it. It took me a really long time to learn to play it. Like, after I wrote it down, I tried to play it. The next day, you know, I went back to bed, and then the next day I got up and tried to play it, and I just, there's no way. It was, like, totally new to me. I had never played anything like it, and so it took me a couple months to actually be able to execute it and understand it. And then it took the group another couple months to be able to, like, really to really grasp it. And even right now, I feel like I'm still learning different things about the tune. There are these things in it that I keep discovering, like these different ways of going between the chords and different ways that the chords are relating to each other that I didn't realize. So it's kind of, I just keep discovering more about it, and it's like kind of still kind of a mystery to me, to be honest.
Inspired by a dream.
Yeah.
So how long, now I take it you're a pianist.
Yes.
Okay, because I noticed your bonus track was a solo piano off of the upcoming album. Now, have you come up with a title for the album yet?
Yeah, it's just going to be called Acoustic. And that's basically because I've put out three albums so far, and they've all been really kind of like half-assed, ad hoc sort of, just like very, very grassroots things. My most recent one was just all recorded live with my Zoom microphone. The album, it's called Radio Over Miles. And I just sold out of it, which is why I'm inclined to do this new album. I just printed 1,000 copies. I released it February of last year. Just actually a couple weeks ago, sold the last copies that I had at one of my shows. But that was all recorded just with the Zoom, just live at this club, Close Up 2 in Chicago. So everything up to this point has been very, very low budget stuff. And I had been kind of saving funds to be able to do a series of what I would consider more legitimate albums, one being acoustic and one being electric. Basically the acoustic one to kind of show more of the roots of what I'm doing, like the kind of show the meat and potatoes of the style that I'm portraying. And then another, that's the one that this is, that's called Acoustic. And then the next one I'm going to release, which will probably be about a year after the release of Acoustic, is going to be called Electric. And that's going to be like all the bells and whistles and all the different colors and timbres and everything that I have in my head, exploratory creative endeavor. So first there's Acoustic and then there's Electric. And this one's Acoustic.
What about Blue and Green?
Blue and Green is the one cover that's on the album. It's credited to Miles Davis, though there's argument with that Bill Evans may have written it. Bill Evans claimed to have written it. Nobody really knows. But the arrangement of it is what's really unique about that specific track. And that the original idea for the arrangement was the drummer, Mekhi McRaven, the drummer on the album. He was like, let's play this Blue and Green tune, but let's do it in a 7/8. Like in a fast 7/8. So it almost feels like a slow swing, but the swing is divided into 7 beats. And you swing on the fifth beat. And so it can either, when you're playing it, the time remains consistent, but you can either play it like it's a really slow swing or like it's a really fast 7/8. For people who are not music nerds out there and don't understand what I'm saying.
Or they're not a drummer in a rock band.
Yeah, or they're not a drummer. that basically means you have like you have 7 beats in a measure, so it's like 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, and the accents are 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, 1 2 3 4 5 6 7, 1 2 3 4 5 6 7. But if you take away all the in between beats, it just sounds like 1 2 da da, which is like 1 and 2 and 3. And 4 and 1 and 2 and 3, like you're just playing a regular swing, you know. But if you divide it up, it's 1 5 1 2 1 2.
With the average listeners not going to also know that the 8 means that an 8th note gets 1 beat.
Exactly. Yeah.
But whereas most music for the average listener is 4/4 is your most common time signature, which means there's 4 beats per measure, and a quarter note gets 1 beat.
Yes.
And 7/8 you'll probably only see in jazz and swing usually. Or Beatles tunes.
0 grams, trans fat, 0 calories, all good, all of the time, Indie Nation.
What about pianists that influenced you? Anybody in particular, instructor even, you know, can be a known, an unknown? Who, I mean, obviously you grew up in a piano home.
Yeah.
So did you ever play any other instrument, want to play any other instrument?
I did. I play a bunch. I played cello in grade school and then trumpet throughout high school. I play a little harmonica and drums and bass and guitar. I've written arrangements for wind ensembles, like large, you know, 40-piece orchestras. So you kind of have to know how to play the instruments at least a little bit if you're going to write for them. The ones that I don't really know are saxophone and violin. I can't even really pick those up. But most of the instruments I've tried to gain some proficiency on just because I've written for them. But influence-wise, though, I do have a major piano influence. All throughout high school, ever since I got into jazz, I'd been listening to Herbie Hancock. He's like the man when it comes to jazz piano. I think probably all of his recordings, unless there are some that I have somehow skipped over. And he actually, at some point, he actually became my spiritual mentor, because I got to know him because I was just backstage at different, like, festivals and things that he was playing. We kind of became friends. He ended up introducing me to this form of Buddhism that he practices, that it involves chanting and meditation. And I was basically, it was at one point when I was asking him about, I was asking him about how his creativity, like how he draws his creativity, because he's always coming up with such a wealth of new ideas, and it always seems so brilliant. And he told me that this thing was one of the things that he used, really one of the main influences that in his life for his music. So I was like, man, if the master of piano can do it, I might as well give it a shot. So I tried it out, and I've been practicing it since then. It's actually been pretty inspiring and pretty mind opening to me. And he and I have been keeping in touch since then. Also, he's kind of been giving me guidance on it. But he's definitely one of my main influences as far as piano and spirituality.
Now, is there any particular piece that he inspired for you? I mean, I understand you're saying general spiritual, general inspiration all around, but you've done quite a range of material, and so has he.
Yeah. Man, I wonder if there's a specific piece. You know, I don't know, actually, if I could even pinpoint a specific piece. Like, I draw a lot of my melodic ideas, a lot of my harmonic content from certain things that he's developed throughout his life, but I don't know if I could really pinpoint a specific song that's more influenced than another by him. You know, there is one song that's influenced by a different pianist very specifically. It's the song called Chicks, off Live in 25, the album that I released in college that we recorded in room 25 of the Smith Hall building. Yeah, the song Chicks is very influenced by Chick Corea, because he was one of the main guys that I was looking into at that point. But yeah, other than that, I don't know exactly, I don't know if I could pinpoint a specific song that's like a Herbie song of mine.
How do you spell Chick Corea's last name? Do you happen to know?
Yeah, Corea.
That's what I thought, but I wanted to be sure. I mean, it sure sounded like that, you know?
Yeah. It's Chickcorea.
Now, you're a big Herbie Hancock fan, and you probably have everything he did. You said, favorite Herbie tune?
Oh, man, favorite Herbie tune. Yeah, I have two, actually, and they're total cliches. My friends make fun of me for it, but I'm a huge fan of, firstly, Maiden Voyage. That's just one of my favorites. I love that tune so much. And that's off the album. It's the song Maiden Voyage off the album Maiden Voyage that he did when he was like, and he must have been late 20s, I think, with Tony Williams. And I believe Wayne Shorter's on the album and Ron Carter's on bass. And it's such an amazing album. I definitely recommend checking out Maiden Voyage for anyone who hasn't checked that out. And then the other tune that I would say is one of my favorites is Chameleon, which every high school jazz band player knows that song. Da 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 da. That one, yeah. So that's the one I get made fun of for, but I love that song. And his solo on that is just ridiculous. That's one of the things that I'm actually going to transcribe at some point, probably soon.
Did he not do the tune Rocket?
Yes, he did Rocket.
What did you think of that one?
I do not like that tune. I mean, I don't like, I'm sorry if Herbie happens to listen to this, I'm sorry. Sorry, dude. But yeah, Rocket is just like, I mean, it's probably a really good tune in the meat of it, but I haven't given it a chance because I just can't stand the sounds of the recording that got really popular.
I knew you were going to answer that way in advance because everybody I know that's a Herbie Hancock fan says the same thing about that tune. Now, to Herbie's credit, though, that's the only instrumental to hit number one on the Billboard.
Yeah.
Ever.
Which, is it ever?
I do believe. I don't think it's ever been broken. I know that when it came out, and the other thing was, when did you ever see Herbie Hancock get airplay on MTV before that?
I know. No, I mean, that definitely helped put him further on the map than he was at that point, which I give him mad props for that, because it's so difficult for a jazz musician to break into that pop culture like that. I mean, that's such a great accomplishment.
You know, there were very few jazz musicians that really broke over to the mainstream. I mean, definitely country artists had a lot more success in the mainstream. And mm-hmm. even more traditional swing artists like Sinatra did. What about Letting It Go? Where did that come from?
Letting It Go, I wrote right after I got back from Thailand. And it was about letting most of the, well, not most, but letting a good chunk of my life go. It was when I was basically, I mean, I had this business that I built up that was kind of keeping, like, that I was making a living off of, the website development thing. And when I got back, I wanted to just not do that anymore, you know? So that tune was basically like the emotions that I was feeling about shedding all these things off of my life, all these things that I didn't really want to have inhibiting my creativity and inhibiting my ability to really thrive musically. And it's about letting all those things go. So it's kind of a somber, like meditative sort of feeling that's like, that feels kind of bare. Cause like when you shed a huge part of yourself, then I guess that's kind of how you feel. So that's what that one's about.
We were talking earlier that I had discovered you over at Mevio's Music Alley, which is formerly the PodSafe Music Network. Where else can a listener find you?
Man, well, the primary place where you can find my music is on my website, which is www.gregspiro.com, which is G-R-E-G-S-P-E-R-O.com. I've got a bunch of free downloads up there from live shows. I've got a bunch of videos up there. And I have a blog, which I'm going to pay more attention to in the future. It's kind of sitting there. It's a little old now. But then also, if you just Google my name, if you Google Greg Spiro, a bunch of stuff comes up. Like, I've got a YouTube channel that has a bunch of videos on it. And, Yeah, but that's probably, gregspiro.com is probably the primary place to check out. Exactly.
If you were going to pick one to push to your audience for a sample, just one, which one would be your first choice?
You know, my favorite track on the album is the first one on there called Hills. That's like, I really like that one. That's probably one that I would pick.
So we'll definitely play some Hills by Greg Spiro. Thank you.
Odds are we're ready in your ears. Take the next step. Let us be the voices in your head. Indie Nation. That's all you.